Podcast Guys has been spared from death and condemned to this duty. Spare yourselves spoilers if you have not read, because they're here.
Good morning, faithful reader.
Welcome, fortunate seeker.
This is Podcast Guys talking erratic errata.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a whirlwind reread of A Practical Guide to Evil, where
a historian
and a literature scholar
tackle the big questions about one of the greatest novels of the age, such as
who gets the glory,
who gets the throne,
and who holds the line.
I believe Toto does.
There's a lot of people in the 15th who remember March Red as the day we proved we could spit in the eye of hell and get away with it. For me, though, it was the first time I ever put on legionary armor with pride. In the end, I think that might have meant more.
Extract from the Forlorn Memoirs, author unknown. In this chapter, Catherine and the Forlorn Hope fight some devils to the death, as it happened. Sorry that took so long, but did I miss anything?
No, I think that was a great summary of this chapter. They do indeed fight some devils.
So, this will come as a shock to a lot of people. I am not and have not been in the Precy Armed Forces. However, you might be more familiar with some of their policies than I am. Armies really like it when you mess with their uniform and dress code and such, right? They take a very warm stance on that.
Broadly speaking, no, surprisingly. But I do have a thing to say once you say what I assume you're going to talk about.
I just think it's really sweet that even though these are, in certain ways, many ways, every way, the bottom of a whole lot of totem poles, even if they're also special because they're Catherine's personal people, the Forlorn Hope has been allowed to do a little bit of arts and crafts. They've all painted their shields with what looks like a golden noose. That's cute.
It is cute. And, I mean, it is worth mentioning that for most of human history, the idea of saying, like, messing with an army's equipment or the, you know, breaking standardization just doesn't mean anything because that's a relatively recent development when it comes to militaries. Hard to say exactly what's going on here, how uniformed the Legions of Terror are. But more importantly, you gotta paint your shield. That's like a whole thing. Units having shields painted to with, you know, something that's important to them or to help them stand out or to, in theory, frighten the enemy, like, for, I don't know, that's just something that was done historically, especially with the the Greeks famously did that, like ancient Greeks. The Roman legions each had their own, you know, signet on their shield. So yeah, it makes sense here. That said, I agree it's very cute that these fellas and ladies got together and did some arts and crafts in the very brief time between being formed as a unit and devil fight.
You know, you are actually reminding me. Back in the day, isn't one of the big stories that Constantine, the Roman emperor, had his soldiers paint their shields with the cross so that they could defeat Saladin or something?
Not Saladin, but yes. The paint with the sign of the Christ, all of that. I thought about bringing that up as well, but decided not to because that came from above and so was actually an act of standardization rather than breaking it. So I didn't think it actually supported my point particularly well.
I recognize what you were saying at this point. When you say came from above, I did hear God said that one.
Well, I mean, according to Constantine, yep. So,
well, we'll see how that works out for him.
We will. We will, at some point in the future, find out how Constantine's whole deal ends up.
So the lieutenant Catherine's speaking to, though, she's speaking to a lieutenant from the Forlorn Hope. He is, frankly, a pretty reasonable and reasoning man, mostly. We'll see a point where he's a bit bluntly extreme, but he's considered and willing to consider. He explains that their use of this symbol is because they've twice avoided the hangman's drop. That would be their original crime, which saw them choose service in the legions rather than execution, and then their desertion leading them into this unit rather than, again, an execution. They've twice avoided the hangman's drop. The men decided we could use the reminder there won't be a third. A pretty sober and reasonable guy, but he is nervous to reveal that.
He is. He informs Cad about this, and then there's an implied pause before Cat responds. When she concedes, as she says, it's not a bad sign, Farrier smiles, relieved. And I kind of wonder here, do you think his fear, like the relief he's feeling, is because he was afraid of disappointment or judgment? Or was he afraid of, I don't know, execution for doing a bad thing, for making light of the situation and angering Catherine? I don't know. The relief there reads to me like this could have gone really bad.
I think it's probably somewhere in between. While the Forlorn Hope is in its interesting position, but very low, they are dregs and they are to be used up. I am betting and assume, do not have an unbearable life most of the time. No more than military life is difficult and battles are deadly and unbearable. But I assume they have rest. They have enough time to paint their shields and enough lack of constant observation that Catherine is discovering this now. Perhaps the most likely negative result would be more along the lines of, I disapprove of this for whatever reason, to whatever extent, and you are all going to take it off, and I'm going to assign you latrine duties for whatever that means for the army for however long or what have you. It's a nope, now you have to suffer, rather than nope, you are dead.
That's fair. I guess also the Gallowborn, as he refers to them here in just a moment. Yeah, we get the name that we all actually know them by right here, which is great. But they kind of live to, you know, in a lot of ways, make up for their desertion. And so they like to try to impress Catherine. So I guess her scorn here would have been a lot more harshly received than delivered. So, you know, that's fair.
But he does announce the name Gallowborn with an E on the end and explains it with born of the gallows and headed for them again, should we falter. Great. That's fantastic. And a sardonic smile tugs at Catherine's lips. Calwyn humor at its finest. And humor is a pretty strong word for this. And I'm familiar with gallows humor, pun unintended and welcomed. But this is actually pretty honest and serious. Is Calwyn humor just bad?
Calwyn humor is, hey, we're lucky to be alive, and if we mess up, we're going to die. Get it?
It's like that old Calwyn joke. What do you call somebody with two horses?
What do you call somebody with two horses?
Somebody lucky to be alive.
Classic. Gosh, I love Calwyns.
Well, I love gobos.
Gobos?
I'm sorry, is that not PC these days?
I think, honestly, given our stance on goblins generally, I think it would be fine for us to say gobos. I think goblins would appreciate that, actually.
No, guys, don't worry. We would have a goblin friend. They would totally have given us permission to say it.
It does sound like that. However, coming from Farrier here, maybe a little rough, especially given the next thing
he says.
Let's
look at it in context.
Yeah. He says, I'll give this to the gobos. They're nasty little pests, but they die hard and loud. The thing is, he does not mean this as a compliment. You know, the second half, yes, but it's like a backhanded compliment, which makes the gobos sound worse. However, that second sentence, they're nasty little pests, but they die hard and loud. If you change that first conjunction, I think the goblins would just fully agree with the sentiment. If it were, they're nasty little pests and they die hard and loud, I think most goblins would just be like, yep, that's us. And it would be a completely fine thing to say.
It'd be like the Nixon tapes if you just ended all the sentences with, but they are a great people and fine and the best and I love them and there's no criticism.
I don't know if it's the same thing, but sure.
Have you ever listened to the Nixon tapes? They are nasty.
I've read some transcripts, not the full thing.
Speaking of a nasty little pest, am I right?
Yikes. Yeah.
But Catherine reacts defensively to this, possibly because she's being microaggressed upon as a half-goblin.
Mm-hmm.
Those goblins are giving their lives to save thousands of innocent civilians, I replied sharply. And Farrier considers for a while, and then says, they are, aren't they? They might do it because orders came from above, but that doesn't change what they're doing. And you know, I'm willing to fault people their biases, but you can't fault a consideration thereof. This is a step, and it's remarkably reasonable. I think this man will never say anything totally unreasonable and unreasoning as he does so.
Yeah, so he basically turns around immediately and asks permission to speak frankly, which Kat grants because she'd rather have this out in the open. And he goes
on. Don't be racism. Please don't be racism.
Oh, don't worry. It's just treason, I guess.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. He just goes on a very brief but harsh tirade against the Empire and the Tower and the Empress, too, which is, you know, probably a pretty universal sentiment. Maybe not universal. A pretty common sentiment in Kalow, including to an extent with Catherine. But he does just come out and say it to the commander of one of the Legions of Terror. Yeah, she's Kalowin too. Yeah, she's named and he's basically dead anyway. That's his whole point at this stage of the story. But that's a bold thing. Catherine says something about she respects it because he's willing to vocalize it. But vocalizing it specifically to the commander of a Legion of Terror? Woof. Good for this guy. Good for Farrier.
The actual good for him part is that she doesn't summarily execute him, because that's the point where it seems most rational from a systemic level.
Right. Both because she has to, potentially, and also to prevent that sentiment from spreading. There's no one else standing right here. Well, they are standing in line, I guess. If she executed him on the spot, I have a feeling that might actually cause some problems, now that I think about it. He's expressing a lot of anger about the Empire, specifically, he's saying, like, I did some bad things, absolutely, but he's upset because he doesn't believe that bad things, that him having done bad things means that he has to kill the enemies of the Precy and then act like it was a favor done for me. The exact sentence is, but that don't mean the Precy get to hand us a sword and order us to kill their foe, then pretend they did us a favor.
So he's talking to someone who literally did exactly that, like, a couple of days ago, for a second time to him. And he's acting as though there's a difference between Price, generally, and Catherine, specifically, for having done the exact same thing.
His logic is not flawed. Like, there is no free choice with a gun to your head, whether that gun be Catherine Foundling, or whether that gun be the threat of starvation and homelessness. But, you know, Catherine points out, you picked enrollment over hanging, and he did so twice, which is explicitly gun to your head. Hanging is when they shoot you.
It's called hanging because the gun kind of hangs off of somebody's finger.
Speaking of guns, fun fact, that's why bullet hands have their name. They have the most painful sting of any insect, and some people actually die from it, even though it's not toxic, because it just induces bad heart things because of the pain.
I'm glad that there aren't any of those where I live.
Okay, we've narrowed it down to most of the universe. Actually, statistically, pretty much all of the universe, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
I'm no statistician. Sorry, I'm just sharing things I'm proud of.
Farrier then goes on to talk about his situation, but in general terms, and more.
Even though he's only a lieutenant.
Nice. And does a great job of sort of just summarizing how government works historically and today and everywhere. He says, there's something wrong with punishing a man for having done bad by sentencing him to commit more bad in the judge's name. And, you know, he goes on, it means the judge is crooked, and if they are, why do they get to punish me in the first place? So here's the thing about governments. They are always incentivized to do exactly this. And he's acting like this is a specifically Precy problem, which is, you know, sure, Farrier, you're right. It is a bad thing. Like, don't get me wrong. It's a bad thing. But it's a much broader issue than his rant would lead one to believe.
No, I'm not really against punitive justice.
Huh?
Well, it would be like being against a unicorn. That which is punitive is not just. Anyway, I agree. if governments want to retain the mandate of heaven, they need to not answer bad with bad and coerce bad.
Hey, that's a fun term you used.
It is a fun term. I capitalized the M and the H.
Yeah. So Catherine also uses that term in her, you know, internal monologue that we read. In fact, she says that the rulers of Callow were heroes with the mandate of heaven behind them. Now, why does Callow have the mandate of heaven? Is that weird to you? It's weird to me.
Callow's got, you know, a little bit of a soft spot in the heaven's hearts. Callow's acknowledged as a province of the heavens.
Okay, yeah. But there's a huge difference. Yeah, there's a massive difference between saying favored of the heavens or that heroes went forth with the backing of the heavens and saying the mandate of heaven, which is a specific political ideology attached to China in the real world. Like, I don't know. This is very, very out of nowhere for me. When I was reading it, just suddenly, oh, the mandate of heaven, of course.
So Prosser is the Holy Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. Callow is China.
Callow is China. And the dead king is, insert, funny political joke of the day.
Okay.
So Catherine acknowledges, again, that Prace makes the trains run on time. And says, if I have to choose between a ruler that is virtuous and one who can balance the national finances, I already know who I'll choose. And that's not an uncommon sentiment pretty much anywhere, fictional or non-fictional. But I would like to propose that maybe Catherine's living in a bad system if virtue doesn't translate to people starving less.
Virtue just means you fight the right people.
Oh.
As long as the government hurts the right people, they're virtuous. This is
so
known.
Callow isn't China, it's Fantasy America. Because we've heard a whole lot of people, one of them must be right.
Now, claiming that America is the only real-life state that operates on a hurt-the-right-people-and-it's-okay philosophy is a bit much.
Name give or take 200 others.
Yeah, you're right, I can't. That said,
you have to look up three words on Google. You have to look up two words. Frankly, you can probably just Bing one word and you'll get where you need if you scroll enough.
Bing? Are we sponsored by Bing now?
No, I wouldn't take Gates' money. No, actually, I would take Gates' money, but I wouldn't do things for him for it. So, the ancient Medesans, you've made very clear, are basically just fantasy Carthage, right?
Yeah.
Well, they're chatting, and Ferrier is pretty happy today in this battle against devils, which, yeah, that's a righteous battle, go for it. He likes what this stands for, he admitted, lightly tapping the 15 and Medesan numerals on his shoulder. There are a lot of ways to do numerals.
Mm-hmm.
Two pretty well-known systems in the West, at least at this point, are Arabic numerals, which are the only numbers that matter on a grand scale in the world, and Roman numerals, which are just letters that have numbers on them.
Yep.
Do you think Medesan numerals saying 15 is actually just gzv?
Yeah, he taps the gzv on his shoulder, and you know, that makes perfect sense.
Okay. I also want to add, for posterity, I really do enjoy some good Roman numerals here and there. I think they add a little bit of spice to rendering of numbers.
Roman numerals are famously spicy.
You know, Romans had a lot of spicy food, like lark's tongues. Did Romans have spicy food? Obviously, they had access. But Roman cuisine.
I think Roman cuisine was mostly just, like, tears of their enemies and blood of the innocents or whatever.
Unless they went to the circus where they got, instead of buckets of popcorn, buckets of bread.
Yeah. Sorry, they also horse urine, famously.
What?
What? Okay, so maybe not for consuming, not cuisine, just for dental hygiene.
Yeah, that's very different.
If it goes in your mouth, you've eaten it, basically.
Modern toothpaste is not something you should eat.
What? It tastes so good, though.
Right.
Just like horse urine, I guess.
But just like horse urine, the government is using it to control our... I don't know.
The horse urine is making the frogs gay?
People are acting like frogs weren't already gay. Look at nature. It's all gay.
We are so far off the rails at this point.
But that's appropriate because there's a song here and people have been asking about a musical episode. I bought a ukulele and we get to the point where we start hearing a, I think, actually in this chapter, unnamed song that's popular in the kingdom.
Unnamed, you could make a pretty solid guess at the title.
By taking a line from within it?
Yeah.
Down here in the mud.
No, the first line, like a hymn.
The knights will get the glory?
Yeah.
Okay, naming a song after its first line isn't bad, though. So many poems are
there's nothing named wrong with
after
it.
Their first lines. Like, yeah. You know Emily Dickinson's poem, I Am Nobody, Who Are You?
Sure.
What's the title of it? I don't know. What's the first line? I am nobody. Who are you? Good enough. Does that one actually have a title?
I do not know. We should just start naming every song after the first line, though.
The Mountain Goats would have a lot of great song titles, but they already have great song titles.
I just like the idea of certain songs having their titles just be utterly unintelligible or just, I don't know, extremely different from what you would expect a song title to be. Like Ozzy Osbourne's hit All Aboard, followed by Laughter. I think that's a great song title. Just force people to laugh a lot every time they're referring to his song.
You know? I can really get behind this. Like, you know what song I really enjoyed? Lady Gaga's 2009 hit, Ra Ra Ah Ah Ah, Ra Ma 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 Ma.
See? Rah, it worked.
Ah Ah Ah.
I think that's more than one line at this point.
Okay, I really like Lady Gaga's 2009 hit, Ra Ra Ah Ah Ah.
See? That's really good.
It actually is. Conceded. Let us refer to all songs in this way from now on and see how long we recall.
Cool. We're going to forget instantly.
Is that the first line of the song about the podcast? Because
the response there is supposed to be forget what. So let's just move on with the actual chapter. They start singing this song.
Knights will get the glory.
The knights will get the glory. And Catherine tells us that every Callowan knows this song because it's not really, even though it's not really sung in the open anymore. And then she says, if the kingdom had ever had an anthem, this was it. Which is a wild thing to say about a song currently being sung by Precy Legionaries. I get it. They're Callowan, but like, kind of rough to be singing another state's anthem in a military.
The anthem of a former state.
A state in rebellion. That's an Abraham Lincoln joke.
Abraham Lincoln, I hardly know one.
All right. Another good Abraham Lincoln joke. And they say comedy comes in threes, so before the end of the episode, let's try to get one more in here.
So, you know how you get the feeling that if you want to actually give an accurate rendering of a Callowan voice, you'd opt for a melange of vaguely English regional accents?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Don't know why that comes up in this episode, but you'd be right to, because Catherine tells us 100 voices chorused, deep and thin, with accents from all over the land. Just a whole bunch of accents, and literally nowhere on earth has that except for England. That's a fun fact. Don't look it up, just repeat it.
I plan to.
But some of the lyrics of The Knights Get the Glory are interesting, because if you listen, so pick up your sword, boy, here they come again, and down here in the mud, it's us who holds the line. And I like it. I play paladins and tabletop role-playing games a lot. This appeal to duty in the face of constant struggle is great. But it's not quite all the way it needs to be there. It's not, there's something missing to make it like a knees, but it's a good hymn to duty. I'm here for it.
Oh, it's very good. It's very Callowan too, because the focus is very much on how awful it is where they are compared to other people. Like, we're in the mud, we're holding the line. This is followed up. We get this line about the, you know, we're down here in the mud, it's us who hold the line. And then we get a description of where Catherine is right now. It's a nice little juxtaposition here because the devils have arrived. And she feels at this moment that Z's finishes the ritual and then phrases the result of that as the ritual, describing the ritual is the one that trapped the devils in here with us. We're down here in the mud. It's us who holds the line. And there's devils trapped in here with us. Not we're down here struggling against devils or, you know, hey, the devils are here. We're trapped with each other. Whoever wins, wins. This is just the statement of they're stuck until we're done with them. Callowans in general, but specifically Catherine, the bravado is just phenomenal.
We're not trapped in here with the devils. They're trapped in here with a demon. Be afraid.
Uh-oh.
I have a question about the lyrics.
Okay.
The princes take the veils. Who are the princes? This isn't the real question. I'm building to it.
Oh, the Proserans.
Where are the veils?
Between Proser and Callow.
The tyrant is at the gate. Who is the tyrant?
presumably the Bracy ruler.
And what is the gate?
Probably just means like the broad idea of the edge of our lands.
It's capitalized. It's a proper noun.
It is. But it probably just means the idea of gate is like a symbol for the threshold to our area. But yeah,
I can give it that. It's just, it feels like there is the gate, even if its proper name were, you know, the gate of opulence or what have you. But the only gates I can really think of from the story so far, Otter is the city of gates, but, you know, the princes go to the highest assembly, the tyrant is in the tower, everything is fine, and we don't have to fight. So, okay, I just don't like the capitalization then, and that's me.
Fair.
And my hatred for capitalization is an old one. Sorry, Calowen hatred for devil kind was an old one, we are told. Which, I know that they have been regularly besieged by devils, but compared to anything else, even like the Lycanese hatred for the Chain of Hunger, devils just seem kind of like a, well, yeah, like strong sentiment, but you can't really express the specialness of not liking devils as much as you don't like devils. Because the thing about devils is they're not liked. Sorry, Kat.
No, but you could also say that they have a personal distaste specifically because on the continent, the people that use devils are the Precy, and the Precy tend to be fighting Kalos. So, you know, there's probably a bit more to it.
Yeah, but...
But, I agree.
I think devils are just the hardest to do this against.
Hey, I have an answer, by the way, for the tyrant is at the gate.
Yes.
Summerholm is called the Gate of the East because it borders Prace. It's the entrance from that Prace has to use to get into Kalo.
You know, I'm going to risk getting caught by the censors. I will be gall darned. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's an actual thing, and it's actually a great line instead of a slightly confusing capitalization.
Throw me in the mud and call me a Calowen? That's nifty.
Yeah.
So then they get to the refrain. We've heard part of this already. And it goes, so pick up your sword, boy. Here they come again. And down here in the mud, it's us who holds the line. I just want to say, can we make it so pick up your sword, girl? We already did a boy verse.
Yeah.
That's just where I am.
No, I don't disagree. I think it's important to remember that despite, in many ways, PGTE having the genders on display being pretty, I don't know, equal in many fields, we do learn early on that that isn't historically always the case in Calurnia, that it's a pretty recent development in some places. So this is an old song. And even without that, people like stories and archetypes and specific characters. Archetypes is the way. And especially Calurnia is going to like that. And so the archetype of the young boy picking up his sword is a very real thing in the real world. And it probably is in Calurnia as well, which isn't to say girls can't do it. That's ridiculous. It's simply
Elizabeth Alban.
Right. It's simply that there's probably a weight of story to the idea of it being a young boy, or at least symbolized as a young boy here. I don't know. I agree. It'd be cool if it were a girl here. I don't particularly hold it against the story that it's not.
I think that's very fair. And I want to note, agreeing with you against me, you can also just have gendered characters in a story or a song.
Oh, yeah.
Like in James Consumes the Planet's famous song, The Center, they do sing, it just takes some time, little girl, you're in the middle of the ride, but fam, have you heard that song? Have we not all been the little girl in the middle of the ride?
Honestly.
And in the interest of citing things properly, I will admit that that was actually Imagine Dragons. So.
Okay.
We finish the song as the devils get to them, which I think reality might not have had to in this case, who knows? But generally speaking, reality will bend a little bit to make that happen.
Sure.
Because the drama of it all.
If you know, three lines before the end, the devils crashed in and the song just peters out, that's nothing. Especially with a named leading them, come on.
And Catherine describes it as the heart of Kalo as a fight, because it's hard-eyed defiance even when the night was at its darkest. And now we're getting even more close to Lycanese virtue. But I don't think we're there yet, because Kalo holds the hope of emerging whole from the conflict, whereas the Lycanese hold the hope of allowing the world to remain as they grip their enemy and drag them down into death with them. And anyway, I love Cordelia.
Yeah. Kinney's version of this would be, what, hard-eyed resolution to destroy the enemy because the night was at the darkest, rather than defiance, even when it is at the darkest. There's a nuance there that definitely separates the two. And it's cool because they both have a thing like this, a vibe that makes them, you know, standing against all odds, but the nuance there splits it a bit. So you definitely get, there's a difference between the average Callowan and the average Lycanese person. And I dig it.
The first difference being how many layers of mud. That said, Muddy Cat has a battle on her hands, and a big old iron-clawed ape leaps over her soldiers trying to get behind the shields, and her hand strikes out like a viper. And I know what we're all thinking, what we're all hoping for. One punch, Catherine, right?
Of course.
But she snatches it by the neck, lets her name flood her veins, and squeezes as hard as she can, snapping its neck like a twig, which is cool and all. But I am a little disappointed. It's not a punch. And Catherine has failed us this chapter. But what Catherine hasn't failed is zoological identification, apparently.
Oh?
One of the big devils comes for her in the wake of this, and it looks like a hyena, or perhaps a nightmarish take of a child on what a hyena would be. Now, Catherine lives in fantasy mud England, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very possibly fantasy mud France. But same thing. I don't think anyone historically would take a problem with, would have any problem with me saying England and France are basically the same polity, right?
No, I think that's very reasonable.
But I'm not an expert, but I think hyenas are from elsewhere, which is fine. I'm curious why Catherine has familiarity with hyenas to the point that she makes a comparison. It's not simply an awareness of hyenas. She needs the image in her head. And I've seen hyenas at zoos. I've seen hyenas in digital and film media. But if it weren't for those, I would maybe have had the chance to see drawings. Where do you think she knows about hyenas from? I don't have an issue with this. I'm just curious. It's kind of out of the way.
Imperial education?
Do they have zoo books?
I mean, why wouldn't they? Or maybe not zoo books. Maybe they have books of various devils, and in there it's, hey, a lot of devils look like animals. Here's some creepy looking animals that some devils can look like.
I think they'd have names for the devils if they had that kind of media, though.
Yeah, I don't know. Hyena is definitely, the problem is, for us, like, hyenas have such a weirdly elevated place in our understanding compared to a lot of animals that do similar things to them. We all, like, for Americans at least, we know what hyenas are and what they look like, which is wild because they're just kind of little nasty scavenger dogs from a different continent.
That are a matriarchal and misandrist society, as we all should be.
But I wonder if the reason we, like, culturally care about hyenas so much is just, hey, sometimes their noise is funny.
And William Shakespeare's The Lion King.
I was going to say, I'm curious if Lion King actually had something to do with it. Like, we know the big ones from other continents. Like, of course we all know what an elephant or a hippo is. Those are big. They're the impressive animals. We know what great white sharks are. But if you start mentioning animals that don't play, that aren't big and flashy, you know, it's pretty quick to get away from what people would be aware of, especially when they're kind of just another kind of dog. Like, why do we know this specific kind of weird dog?
When did Hamlet come out?
90s, probably. 94.
Okay, hyena began a major upswing, according to Google Books Ngram Viewer, in 88.
Huh.
But 94 was still pretty low in that upswing. And we're at an all-time high right now.
Because of this podcast?
Yes, actually.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know. It might just be one of those things that, you know, this is her Slumdog Millionaire moment.
Slum Hyena Millionaire.
Her Slum Hyena Millionaire, yeah, sorry.
So she's fighting this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaps at her.
It does.
And Catherine tells us, I took the impact, but the monster was heavier than I'd thought. Its mass was enough to blow me off my feet as it cackled madly. One, cackling. Nice hyena trait. But two, where did the anime go? Remember last battle against the devils when she was struck and she left a furrow like 20 feet long as she was pushed back?
Her feet dug into the ground as she... Yeah, yeah.
I literally have read a manga series now, which I hadn't by that point, and I have to say, that's very anime. Manga is what happens when they take pictures of animes and put them in a book for everyone.
I mean, it's moderately anime. She does go flying backwards, bounce off of something, and then land in a crouch. That's pretty anime.
A crouch is anime. Oh, well. So I'm just disappointed. She fights this thing a bunch, rams a dagger in his eye, whatever.
Yeah, you know, fighting stuff.
It does bleed smoke instead of blood, which is kind of fun. And then it body slams her again, and she was ready for it this time. Her name flared, and she weathered the hit without flinching, her footing unimpeded. That's a little more anime. She's getting back in the zone.
There's a blow that knocks her through the air, and then when she's ready for it, she prepares and can no-sell that same attack. Yeah, that's extremely anime to just say no thank you to this one.
It's the same mechanism where when you're in a race against someone and your cars are right next to each other and one pulls ahead and then the other one pulls ahead and the other, if you really are focused on it and concentrate, you can make your car go faster than theirs.
Right.
Sorry, Chariot. PGT.
Good. Nice job staying in setting. I appreciate it.
Thank you. She gathers the threads of power wreathing her, forces them around her fist, and sucker punches the devil in the stomach with a snarl. Catherine does a punch. She gets it together, she pulls an anime, and she does a punch. She's back. Our baby girl is ready.
Last time she punched a devil, it worked out really well for her.
And she breaks her other leg? No.
Just, you know, rather than breaking a leg and suffering physical damage, she says something that is dealing emotional damage, psychic damage, I don't know what you want to call it.
To me, it is. She rams her sword into its other eye and says, "Welcome to Marchford." And as it falls to the ground lifeless, she says, "Don't let the door hit you on the way out."
Oh, no.
And I mean, she's in a life and death combat. She's working so hard. And she's the lamest little girl on Neshima's blighted earth.
She has like, so many good one-liners and such good banter in so many battles. And here she says, "Don't let the door hit you on the way out." I guess it's good that she saves her good material for, like, people who can actually appreciate it, because the devil won't, but yikes, Kat.
It applies so poorly that I am beginning to worry she actually rehearsed this.
It's so bad.
Oh, it's going to be so good. I'll knock a demon to the ground, and I'll stab through its throat, and I'll say, "Don't let the door hit you on the..." Oh, it's going to be so cool. Isn't it going to be cool, Hakram?
The first one I fight, I'll say, "Welcome to Marchford," and then I've got a follow-up line. Oh, man. What a mess.
But they really begin to take hold of the battle, and that's when the second wave of devils moves. And that's fine and all, but I want to remind everyone, we started with 100 devils, which is a magically significant number, just like pi. But they've been killing a bunch of these. Catherine has killed half a dozen herself that we've read. She killed 6% of the enemy host, ignoring the spears.
Well, keep in mind, also, only 80 showed up here. Because 20 were killed in the previous encounter.
So the big devils are coming now. The little devils are all terrible, but the big devils are things like the Megadapes, which I think would be a great band name.
Not bad.
But there are four coming in, two Megadapes, and then some bull's ugly cousin. Fantastic descriptions. Honestly, no notes. I fully mean, a lizard trying really hard to be a tiger is a great description.
Oh, yeah.
However, these are still some of the big devils, and Catherine looks at the four coming. I know she can't handle them all, but she looks at these other two and says, "Those I'd leave to the Galloborn, but the apes had a real chance of making the shield wall collapse if they managed to reach it." And Catherine, I know you fought some of the ape things, so you know they're bad, but you can just assume this isn't going to be good for them.
Yeah.
And you're allowed to acknowledge that. They're here to die.
It is a pretty casual way to refer to something that is being described as, you know, being similar to a tiger going after your allies. But, you know, she's got monkeys to cut up with a sword.
Some monkey business.
It's got some monkey business to attend to.
Wow. You know, that actually sounds like a good and wonderful line in comparison to Catherine. One ape goes to challenge her, one goes to move past her. And so she lances some shadow into its stomach, muscles and bones shattering, maggots flying everywhere. Love that muscle shatter.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, it's bad form to ignore a lady when she asks for a dance, which she did not do.
No.
She did nothing to...
This is the first mention of anything to do with dancing.
She didn't even try to get its attention. She just walked forward. And so I'm beginning to wonder, since she lost Seek, do you think she got a new aspect of reach? Because this sure is one.
That's really good.
Or I know that didn't really happen, because her name is kind of broken, and her soul, but meh.
Name, soul, body. Yeah, she's just not doing well. But we do learn that as a result of that, she struggles a bit more, and not the cool kind of struggle, but like the normal person kind of struggle against these monsters, these devils, because she can't draw as deep from her name anymore. The well of power felt shallower now. And she even says that it might run dry if she's careless. She doesn't have access to all of the power a full name would give her, which makes perfect sense. But the fact that there's an endurance aspect of that, too, is interesting. It's not that she only lacks a variety of power or flexibility of power, or that she only lacks a certain amount of strength. It's also endurance. And that's, you know, there's a lot going on here.
She doesn't have the full powers of a name. She doesn't have the full powers of a transitional name, even. But this is a theme for a lot of the book. Not necessarily exactly like this, but Catherine often has to carefully manage, or decides to carefully manage, how she draws on her name or her power set at the time. Right now, it's that the well of power is too shallow. She cannot risk draining it too soon. Later on, at some points, I'm thinking anti-lunar fairy dust.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't dare draw on it because the well of power is too deep, or draw too powerfully on it. I mean, at that point, nothing can stop her except a woman who is a sword.
Sure.
Or actual gods. Or Rumena. Yeah, Catherine's pretty weak. That was the point I was making, I think.
Yeah, I fully agree, of course.
But she does know how to fight.
She does. And decides to mentor some devils in the art, I guess.
What?
So she's like fighting those devils. And out of nowhere, much like the dance comment, she just says, lesson the first. The most important parts of fighting are distance and footwork. Let's try that again. She suddenly just, her transitions are, she's doing bad banter, and then she transitions into just a different routine, like a different stand-up routine mid-set, and it's also not great. Like, oh man, it's rough because she does know how to do this really well, like we've said before, but this fight is just a rough one. And also, it's awkward because she's, you know, being real flippant with these nonsensical comments towards devils while her soldiers around her are dying in droves. She's fighting two of them while whatever there's left, 30 devils are tearing holes in her lines, and it's just, let me teach you a bit about fighting, my friends. It's just very strange.
But then she even transitions that a little bit. Not to them, thankfully, but her lessons are in the fraternal or avuncular style of, you know, I'm going to slap you around a little as I do this and teach you. Not quite a snark because of the power differential and the ultimately beneficial goal, but, you know, a little bit of messing with you. And then to us, she suddenly turns mystic 80s film martial arts master, proverb spewing nonsense, because as they charge her, she tells us, I did not move, because moving out of fear was wasteful. I did not strike, for striking without purpose was meaningless. Catherine, you're not that cool. Especially after the last 5 minutes.
I mean, you say that, but she does earn this line to an extent, because the devil rushes her and she cuts one's head off and blasts the other one, and they continue running, and then a heartbeat later, and then both corpses fall together. She fully, like, animes these two guys.
Oh, okay. If she's back to anime, she's cool again.
And after she does that, she brushes a few maggots off her shoulder, which is honestly fantastic. It's back to being great.
I disapprove, though, tactically, because last time she was really quick to avoid those maggots. What if one of them, you know, the mummied her like a scarab? What would happen then?
Well, it wouldn't be good.
Side note, The Mummy is a great film that I haven't seen in 20 years, so maybe it's not. But it felt like one back then.
No, it's pretty fun.
And I do love the entire cast.
It's pretty fun. Still a fun time. It won't be your favorite movie of all time if you watch it today, but you'll have fun with it.
It's good. Want to go watch The Mummy?
Normally I would say yes, but unfortunately we are out of time for today.
Join us next time on Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata to watch The Mummy or to discuss...
A Legion with that dog in it.
A Flame with that snake in it.
And a horse with that baby in it.
And maybe a Tomb Raider with that scarab in it?
Wade in their blood.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a fan-made podcast discussing Erratic Errata as a practical guide to evil. Check out the full serial at practicalguidetoevil.wordpress.com. Intro music for this episode was The Cradle of Your Soul by Lemon Music Studio. Music for the epigraph was Creepy Look by Universe Field. Outro music, which even now is elevating my voice to the realms of the divine, is The Price of Freedom by Daddy S Music. The music is provided by the generous license of Pixabay.com. Go and support all the artists who make this work possible by providing their stories and sounds free of charge. If you'd like to support this podcast, follow us on Twitter at The Long Price. Do you have questions? Comments? Contributions? Are you overwhelmed by the urge to correct our errors? Email us at thelongprice@gmail.com. If you'd like to materially support our work, find our Patreon at patreon.com/PGTEE. Join the ranks of our patrons and be called by name, receive personalized stories and art, and access a few other things. I instructed our people to put a podcast clip up there this week, so today there should be something new. If not, don't blame me, blame my people. We implore you, don't consider joining unless you're already supporting the artists who make this all possible. Special thanks to our patron and villainous hero, Gray, our patron and Liege, always the claimant, never the named, our patron and guardian, the Fae Knight, our patron and mentor, the traveling teacher, our patron and dear friend, Aaron, our patron and inspiration, the hopeful romantic, as well as the hordes of cattle below. Next week, Chapter 30, Deliver!